Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with recent criticism of Trump's domestic and foreign policy coming from Senator McCain, former President George W. Bush, and former Vice President Joe Biden, and speak with a foreign policy advisor to Joe Biden, Dr. Michael Carpenter, a former Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense and Director for Russia on the National Security Council. He joins us to discuss the price the U.S. is paying for the absence of leadership in U.S. foreign policy because of a disengaged and disruptive president who has little knowledge of or interest in global affairs and has not staffed his government with foreign policy and national security professionals. With Iraq about to explode as our allies, the Kurds, are being squeezed by Iran, whose influence in Iraq and Syria grows with the emergence of the Shia Crescent land corridor from Tehran to Damascus, we will assess how much the generals around Trump, who are preoccupied containing him, are not able to pay sufficient attention to the roiling global events that demand daily attention, if not a strategy to deal with them. Then we'll look into the latest expensive headline grabbing by fringe groups on the far right wing like Breitbart, David Horowitz, and Richard Spencer's National Policy Institute, who deliberately choose to speak on liberal campuses like Berkeley, where they are not welcome, to provoke students from minority communities with racist insults in the hope that they can extort media attention and become martyrs for free speech. Clay Calvert, the Brechner Eminent Scholar in Mass Communication and Director of the First Amendment Project at the University of Florida, Gainesville, joins us to discuss the $600,000 expense incurred by his public university today because Richard Spencer decided to speak there, even though a handful of students wanted to hear him, while thousands showed up to protest Spencer, shouting, "Go home, Nazis." Then finally, we will speak with another professor at the University of Florida, Gainesville, Michael Gorham, about a different subject, the latest Kremlin-approved straw man to run against Vladimir Putin in Russia's next presidential election. A professor of Russian studies whose latest project is Russia's Digital Revolution, Language, New Media, and the Unmaking of Civil Society, joins us to discuss how this time the daughter of Putin's political mentor, who is Russia's equivalent of Kim Kardashian or Paris Hilton, will be running to split the opposition vote. And joining us now, Dr. Michael Carpenter, who is a former Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense with responsibility for Russia, Ukraine, Eurasia, the Balkans, and conventional arms control. He previously served in the White House as a foreign policy advisor to Vice President Joe Biden and as Director for Russia at the National Security Council. Prior to that, he was a career Foreign Service officer with the State Department, and he's now Director of the Biden Center for Diplomacy and Global Engagement at the University of Pennsylvania. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Michael Carpenter.
Thanks. It's great to be with you.
Well, thank you, Michael. And your former boss has actually spoken out, even though President Trump has insulted President Obama on a number of occasions. He's accused him of wiretapping him at Trump Tower. He said he was a bad, sick guy. The president has held his powder, even though he was even accused recently of not honoring the fallen, which, of course, was a monstrous and disgusting lie. But I noticed that Vice President Biden actually spoke out the other day rather forcefully. What did you think of that?
Well, I think Vice President Biden has seen that some of the actions and irresponsible rhetoric from Mr. Trump has just simply gone too far, and he feels like he can no longer sit on the sidelines and he has to speak out. And so I think he wanted very much to give a little bit of time and space to the new administration before offering any criticisms or even commentary on what they were doing policy-wise. But it's just gotten to a point where I think he's felt the need to speak out, and so you've seen him do it.
So in terms of, we know we're being distracted all the time, and arguably that is a tactic on the part of President Trump. You could describe it as government by stunt, where we're always being whipsawed from one disaster to another. And in the case, for example, of this current scandal over the soldiers that were killed in Niger, the last thing we're talking about is what's our mission in Niger, what happened to them, etc. We're talking about other things, and that's the way that President Trump appears to have steered it. Do you see that as a method to his madness, or do you think he's just somewhat out of control?
Well, I think it's a little bit of both. I think on certain occasions, certainly he's tried to change the media narrative by issuing a tweet on something that he knows is going to gain a lot of attention and sway the media from one topic to another. But I think sometimes he's just so undisciplined that he creates crises for himself that are of his own making and that were unintentional. So I think you've seen both over the course of the last 9 months or whatever it is.
So how is this? I mean, I'm assuming, and I'm pretty sure this is the case, that this is taking a toll on U.S. foreign policy, that we know that there's a huge vacuum, particularly in the State Department, in terms of personnel and slots that are still open. And we know from what the chairman, the Republican chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, has said, Senator Corker, that the White House is something like an adult daycare center, and the assumption being that the generals spend an awful lot of their time containing, I think is the word that Corker used, containing President Trump. This means that they're not spending their time doing what you and Vice President Biden and Obama and everybody else in the National Security Council was doing in the previous administration, which is taking care of this unpredictable, roiling world out there.
No, I think that's absolutely right. I think there are too many distractions. There are too many vacant chairs in our national security apparatus. And the president is so undisciplined and creates so many crises, as I said, of his own making that we've got one hand, probably two hands, actually tied behind our back in terms of our ability to cope with global challenges right now. And there's a lot of them. There's North Korea, there's Iran, there's Russia. There's so many things going on, and yet we are incredibly hamstrung by this administration's both ineptitude, unwillingness to fill key, very important positions in the State Department, the Defense Department, elsewhere, and then by this sort of reckless rhetoric that is coming from the White House. And so we have lost a lot of standing with our allies, not just with our allies, but with countries around the world. I mean, I travel all the time, and a lot of foreign interlocutors want to know what the heck is going on in Washington and seek to understand, you know, who is actually directing the ship of state. Who should they talk to when they come to Washington? And it's very hard to advise them because you don't really know. But I think you're also right in that, you know, Secretaries Mattis and Tillerson and National Security Advisor McMaster are interlocutors that are available, but they spend so much time trying to contain or trying to pass policies that rise below the threshold where they need to be notified to the president, that just simply consumes a great part of their day. And by the way, that is what they do. They try to pass policies at their level that don't rise to the president's level, so they don't have to face the risk that something is going to get hijacked or blown up.
My understanding is that some of the more recent moves, which have certainly upset the allies, decertifying the Iran deal, for one, and the sort of final sort of knife in the back of Obamacare, both of those were something along the lines of a compromise where the adults basically fought as much as they could to preserve what they could, particularly with the Iran deal, but had to basically, because he is the president and was apparently insistent, almost, you know, having tantrums on getting his way, that you end up with these compromises, which is an extraordinary situation itself. My sense is that that ought to be a lesson to all of us, particularly people who don't vote, to recognize that presidents have enormous power. I mean, it sounds like somewhat trite, but I don't think people recognize the extent to which, just because of his own demands and personality, U.S. foreign policy has to bend to his whims.
No, I mean, that's absolutely right. And the president has enormous authority, and so the incumbent of that office is able to do a lot of things that are potentially harmful for our national security interests. And that's why it's such an important position. But that's also why you see Congress stepping in at least a little bit, or at least you did on the Russia issue with passing the Countering America's Adversaries Act, which basically provides the executive branch with additional authorities to be able to sanction Russia for its malign behavior. You saw that pass with majorities of 419-3 in the House and 98-2 in the Senate, and it essentially blocks Trump from being able to unilaterally lift sanctions on Russia, which is what he tried to do when he first came into office in January. So you see Congress trying to exert a little bit more of a role to check the executive, but of course the executive has so much power on, particularly on foreign policy and national security issues, that is difficult to do that.
So let's turn to some of the more important foreign policy theaters that seem to be roiling at the moment. I think most of all, what just happened in Iraqi Kurdistan seems to have the greatest potential for a major explosion. First of all, the Syrian Kurds who've just taken Raqqa and the Iraqi Kurds are America's boots on the ground. They've proven themselves to be the only reliable partner in rolling back the Islamic State in both Iraq and Syria. But the Barzani government in the Iraqi Kurdistan went ahead with a referendum, which was extremely ill-advised. My sense is that there wasn't enough engagement from President Trump and his people to dissuade them from doing what they did. And now you have a situation where the Iraqi Quds Force and the General Suleiman, who is as far as America's concerned, is a war criminal. He's responsible for killing a number of Americans during the Iraq War. He's running the show there on the ground. And this is a very explosive situation. The Kurds have been sold out before by Iran. They've got enemies all around them, Turkey, Iran, and now Baghdad. Kirkuk was their cash cow, their form of economic, their economic lifeline, if you will. And everybody's armed to the teeth there. So if you were still in the Pentagon, my sense is that you and your colleagues, your hair would be on fire.
Well, absolutely. I mean, this is a failure of diplomacy, and it required the United States to be in constant contact with Barzani and with the Iraqi Kurdistan region leadership to avert what just happened, which is, as you said, an ill-advised referendum, which was then followed by the reaction from the other side, which was the Iraqi government in alliance with Iranian Shia militia taking Kirkuk from the Kurds, which is the lifeline for their economic sustainability as an independent entity within Iraq, taking it away from them and thereby cementing Iran's greater role in the region, which has already been growing over the course of the last several months in Syria, particularly in southern Syria, as Iranian militias seek to create a land bridge through southern Syria into Lebanon. And, you know, this administration claims to be they issue a lot of anti-Iranian rhetoric, which is fine. I mean, Iran is in many ways our adversary across the entire region, across the world. But they haven't taken the diplomatic actions that are necessary to check Iran. And so, paradoxically, even though their rhetoric has been scaled up and they've fought against the Iranian nuclear deal, they've allowed Iran to accumulate vastly more power on the ground in the Middle East than it had 3 or 4 or 6 or 9 months ago. And so, yes, this is a huge challenge. And you've got Russia in the mix, obviously. Now you see that, for example, the Syrian Kurdish leaders are traveling to Moscow to try and do deals with the Kremlin because they see Russia as the major power in the region, and they're not being courted, they're not being talked to by the United States, at least not as much as they were in the past. And so that's a direct, tangible consequence of our scaled-back diplomatic initiative in the Middle East.
And the Russian military forces, along with the Iranians, Hezbollah and Assad's forces, are, what, a couple of miles outside of Raqqa, which the Kurds just took. So that itself is a very tenuous situation. But let's just focus for a little longer on the Iraq situation. My understanding is that our policies there are predicated upon the idea that we want the current incumbent Abadi to win the next elections, and we don't want Maliki to come back, because he's even worse. But what guarantees do we have that the Iranians will let us have an engagement there? Because, as you pointed out, they're getting more and more influence there. They've got their militias on the ground. If the U.S. tears up the deal with Iran, the P5+1 deal, the Supreme Leader just said yesterday that if it happens, he'll tear it to pieces in reciprocity. So What happens if things really get worse with Iran, if Trump goes ahead and kills the Iran deal and they feel they've got nothing to lose but to flex their muscles? They're there, they're right next door. Couldn't they cause us a lot of grief?
Well, I think the first thing to say is that we shouldn't delude ourselves that we have the authority or the standing to be able to help a body win re-election in the first place. I think our influence there is very limited. They're going to have an election. They're going to decide on their own. And yet, at the same time, the fact that our diplomatic standing is so much reduced, or has been so much reduced over the last several months, certainly plays into the problems that will result if Abadi loses and Maliki comes back to power, or if some other more pro-Iranian leader comes to power in Baghdad. That is obviously very detrimental to our interests and is likely to lead to further conflict inside Iraq between Sunni populations, between the Shia majority in the south, and between the Kurds in the north. And so our ability to contain or help defuse a future conflict is vastly reduced as a result. And that does not serve our interests, given how much blood and treasure we've expended in that country over the course of the last years.
But it looks as though that our best ally, if you will, in that neighborhood, the Kurds, are going to get squeezed from all sides. Iran, already, they've taken Kirkuk, and Baghdad, which in collusion with Iran. And then you've got Turkey, where Erdogan is quite adamant about curtailing any independence. He's already sent, they already did military maneuvers with the Iraqi army on the border with Iraqi Kurdistan. And we know that Erdogan is hysterical about U.S. foreign policy vis-a-vis Gulen being here in the United States, and there's a trial going on in New York that might well lead to the fingerprints of his family, Erdogan's family, involved in corrupt dealings with Iran to circumvent sanctions. So that could also strain things even further. So is there anything that the U.S. can do? And I imagine, by extension, Israel, too, because Israel's made an investment in relations with Kurdistan. If Kurdistan goes under or is basically landlocked, isolated, isn't that a big setback?
Yeah, well, you know, the region is a mess, and trends are going in the wrong direction, a lot of them you've just cited. I think, you know, particularly important is the Iraqi Kurdistan region's loss of Kirkuk, which now makes them non-viable as a quasi-independent entity within Iraq, and that will change the geopolitics of the region. And before, you know, 6 months ago, a year ago, you had a very good relationship between Erdogan, actually, and Barzani, not between Turkey and the Syrian Kurds, who were at each other's throat, but between Turkey and Iraqi Kurdistan, you actually had a pretty good relationship. Now that relationship is soured, and so that makes things much more complex. And then, of course, you've got the Syrian Kurds, who are being squeezed, but frankly, who are a little overextended. A lot of them have gone as far south as Deir ez-Zor, and as you say, they're about to take or are in the process of taking Raqqa right now. But Raqqa is a historically Sunni city. It is not a historically Kurdish city. And so it doesn't make sense to have the Kurds stay there as a holding force once they clear it of foreign ISIS fighters. And what that signals to me is that over the next couple years, unfortunately, we've set the conditions for the possible creation of ISIS 2.0, because a lot of the local population that were sympathetic to or joined up with ISIS in places like Raqqa, they will remain on the ground and they will be hostile to any occupying force, whether it's Kurdish or Russian or Assad regime, and they will stay there and they will eventually come back. And so, you know, without some sort of clearer governance structure in the region, where entities, where ethnic groups control regions that they have historically controlled and govern them based on their own strictures, we're in for a very, very tumultuous time, both in Syria, in Iraq, in southern Turkey, and bodes very poorly for the region and for our interests there.
Well, just in closing, Dr. Michael Carpenter, What do you think's going on with Israel in terms of its strategic thinking? Clearly, the Israelis and the Saudis, they have some sort of de facto alliance, it would seem, at least in terms of opposition to Iran. I don't know whether they want the U.S. to fight their wars for them, but they're certainly quite hawkish about Iran. But at the same time, they must be worried about growing Iranian influence in Syria, given the role of the Quds and of Hezbollah, and now they're battle-hardened and trained with an enormous amount of equipment. And as you mentioned, they look like they'll get their land bridge, the so-called Shia Crescent, all the way from Iran into the Mediterranean. And at that point, Israel has to feel pretty threatened, don't they?
Well, they do feel threatened, and Prime Minister Netanyahu opposed the so-called de-escalation concept that Turkey and the Kurds had agreed in southern Syria. I think that he's probably very worried right now, and yet he's opposed vociferously to the Iran deal, which doesn't really make any sense. It's an ideological position which I think is actually contrary to Israel's national security interests, but that's the position that he's articulated. And his number one foreign policy priority when coming to Washington has always been to advocate for scrapping the nuclear deal and for getting a new deal, which obviously is not going to happen. And so Israel is very vulnerable, but some of the vulnerabilities are frankly of its own making, at least as far as this current leadership is concerned in Israel.
Well, Dr. Michael Carpenter, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thanks for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Dr. Michael Carpenter, who's a former Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense with responsibility for Russia, Ukraine, Eurasia, the Balkans, and conventional arms control. He previously served in the White House as a foreign policy advisor to Vice President Joe Biden and as Director of Russia at the National Security Council. Prior to that, he was a career Foreign Service officer with the State Department and is now Director of the Biden Center for Diplomacy and Global Engagement at the University of Pennsylvania. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the $600,000 expense incurred by his public university today because Richard Spencer decided to speak there.